This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so that means it is time for our Week in Review. A woman in her 60s from Hampshire County died from a vaping-related illness this week, and the nation has now had its first teenage death. Meanwhile, Massachusetts vape stores are struggling and suing as they see business head north to New Hampshire. Here's Dennis Yabah from Everett.
No matter where I gotta go, I'm gonna go and get them. You know, if they ban them over here, then I'll go to the next state that's got them, you know?
Others say they've picked up cigarettes instead. Here's vape shop owner Dave Burchard of Vape Daddies.
No joke, I've spoken with at least 25 people since the ban went into effect who have told me, I'm back on the cigarettes. I just want out. I couldn't get juice. I'm now smoking again.
Governor Charlie Baker told WCVB he feels for the vape shop owners but is still standing behind the ban.
The flip side of that is to continue to have the store owners sell something when I just had a whole room full of medical experts tell me that this is potentially extremely harmful and possibly fatal, and nobody really understands why, just made no sense to us at all.
Here with us to help us review this and our other Week in Review topics is Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us in Studio 3 is Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
And Marie, before we start, I just want to acknowledge that you're the CEO of a cannabis company that wants to open multiple recreation and medical marijuana shops in Boston.
That's correct.
Okay.
And while this
And while this is different from a vape store, it is possible to vape marijuana products, and that's why we
correct.
Wanted to raise it. All right. So let's jump in. You, call. Do you think the vaping ban has been effective, or do you think it should be overturned? Do you vape? And what has your experience been like since the ban, if you do? Have you gone to New Hampshire? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and you can join the conversation. All right, we had a real tragedy happen this week with the death of a Massachusetts woman. Nationwide, there have been at least 23 fatalities linked to vaping, according to the New York Times. Five just since the beginning of October, and the first teenager was a 17-year-old from New York. Does that signal to you that Governor Baker was right to pursue a ban on all vaping products, that this is a deadly product, Marie?
Well, you have people dying, and so I think that the governor acted decisively, and I think our collective goal should be to try to figure out what's happening. I mean, this is it's new. Pretty much in terms of e-cigarettes and the various number of products that are made available now. And many of them are unregulated and haven't been appropriately tested. So I think it's a tough weighing. I think, though, that he acted decisively in calling this ban, then they need to be moved forward just as swiftly to define where they're going to go with it so it's not endless, because there are other interests on the other end. And so I support him taking the time out to figure this out, but we need to do it quickly.
Jennifer, what do you think?
I disagree. I'm generally not in favor of prohibition when it comes to alcohol or cigarettes or vaping. And the truth is that vaping is much better for you than smoking. It does not cause cancer. It's that simple. And most of the people who use it for replacement of smoking. Now, a lot of teenagers use it, you know, to be cool and for various other things. But the truth is that most of these deaths have come, and these health-related injuries have come from black market products, where the stuff that's been put into the vape, and I don't know that much about it because I've never done it, but it's black market stuff, and the what they're putting into the vaping machine, for lack of a better word, not machine, but
cartridge,
is contaminated. And they say that at least 87% of health-related issues are due to contaminated or black market products.
All right, so that raises the blunt instrument question for me. Here is Dr. Michael Siegel. He's a professor at Boston University School of Public Health, who also worked as a tobacco control expert at the Centers for Disease Control.
When you give out really vague messages, the public doesn't respond to that. People need to know specifically what to avoid. It would be like if we had an outbreak of contaminated lettuce and the health department put out a warning saying, do not eat any vegetables. that's not helpful. People are not going to stop their habits like that.
Now, of course, there are also doctors who fully support the ban, but this was an all-or-nothing kind of ban.
Correct.
Whereas Rhode Island, for example, banned flavored vaping products. There haven't been any deaths in Rhode Island. Was this too blunt an instrument, or was it just right, Marie?
I think I don't know that I know enough to tell you that it's just right. I think that I would rely on the experts who are medical experts to help us figure this out. We are talking about new products that are being created. And I agree with Jennifer that perhaps there are illicit products. That's what we're talking about. But we don't know. And I think what they're trying to figure out right now is what are the sources of this death, these deaths? Where did the product come from? What was the agent that caused it? That's what they're trying to figure out. And unlike us being able to figure out whether or not it was one kind of lettuce or another kind of lettuce, in this new market for these new products, it's very difficult to define that. And so I do think we taking a time out, though it has, again, we have to act swiftly in order to protect the health and safety of the public is smart, that we do need to take the time out to rule out. And we will find then in that short period of time, if allowed, that there are products, the nicotine products that we're talking about, that they'd be able to rule that out and they can do that definitively. But I don't know at this point whether or not the public health and safety officials in this state can give a recommendation to any government official to with some any level of certainty to say these products are a problem.
The problem with a ban is, as the package alluded to, is that people are going over to the border to buy these things. And I personally know of at least two college students who, ahead of the ban, stockpiled the stuff and are selling it out of their dorm rooms now. So, you know, the free market finds its way around prohibitions like this, and not necessarily in ways that we like, because then we can't regulate and control.
So we did a story here on WBUR earlier this week about people going over the New Hampshire border. Actually, one of our photographers captured this remarkable picture in a parking lot outside a store in New Hampshire. All the license plates on the cars were Massachusetts license plates. Here is Israel Rolone of Boston. He says he used to smoke cigarettes. He switched to vaping, wants to stay with vaping. So he goes to New Hampshire to stock up.
I feel like they're just trying to push us back to cigarettes. You know, so instead of doing that, came up here, grabbed the pods.
I think there's a real public health quandary here between keeping people safe. We do not know what is causing these deaths. We don't. Some of it looks to be black market. Not all of it looks to be black market. I think the percentage you used, Jennifer, was 87%.
Almost 90%.
Yeah. And when people can't access vaping, if they're going to take in nicotine, many are going to New Hampshire. On the other hand, Governor Baker allowed for pharmacies to provide free nicotine supplement products to people who needed them without a prescription. This feels like an unknown question of balance. What are the considerations in finding that balance? Jennifer.
Well, and first of all, I just want to say that the organization for which I work, the Independent Women's Forum, does take a strong stance against banning vaping and in favor of the free market and enforcing the current regulations that are on the books with respect to vaping products, right? You don't sell to kids and, you know, these things go through the FDA and we're in favor of all of that. But the truth is, you know, these products are very helpful for people who are trying to quit smoking. And there are a lot of people who say they are much more effective. Actually, studies show they are it's much more effective than the patch, nicotine gum, because part of the addiction to smoking, I mean, part of it is the physical addiction to the nicotine, but part of it is also using your hands, having something to put in your mouth. All of those other aspects of
the
smoking,
physical comfort of it.
Exactly, are things that people miss when they give up smoking. And so the vaping actually really helps with that.
All right, I want to grab a couple calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nathan from Haverhill, go ahead.
Hi. The question I have is that I guess I haven't heard answered or I've missed is I just don't understand why all of a sudden we don't understand the dangers with vaping and yet we created a ban for it. Well, we do understand the dangers of smoking.
Exactly.
And we do understand the dangers of alcohol, and those aren't banned. And it just seems like a knee-jerk reaction to a one-time incident that really isn't solving any problem.
Nathan, thanks for that call. That also raises the question of, so Nathan's saying, well, okay, if this is bad, why don't we ban some other bad things? There's a flip side to that, Marie, which is if a court, which is going to consider suspending the ban next week, doesn't, does this set precedent that the governor can take lots of things and simply say, we're going to ban those now?
See, I do think it's for government officials, it's a very tough position. And it's not one incident. And so in terms of the other items, there have been tons of research done on nicotine products. And so you can understand dosage, you can understand impact. And so you have much more to rely on to make a decision. So in this particular instance, it's not all products. And I think that's the quandary, because I'm thinking, if I was in that position and was asked to make a decision, what are the things that I needed to consider? And so I would have to consider, what is the research out there? What is currently being regulated? The illicit properties that are being sold out there, but in this instance, they don't know, and I think they're asking for a timeout. And I don't. It's not that I'm for prohibition. Obviously, I'm not for prohibition, but I am against people dying. Against people dying of things that we don't know and don't have an answer for. And so, if it gives government the opportunity, a window to figure it out in order to save a life, I say save a life.
All right, I want to grab one more call, and then I'm going to give Jennifer the last word on this before we shift gears. Dave from Roxbury's on the line. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, you know, while I think that this ban is, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I will say that I'm a former smoker, and I've been chewing the gum for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. And I stupidly picked up a Juul, like, in August. And I got to say, I was back addicted to, you know, smoking, essentially, to Juuling within a week. And what struck me most about the Juuling is, you know, your previous speaker was talking about, you know, that it's, you know, sort of the pattern of using your hands and putting something in your mouth. I mean, what I'll say is the number one difference between smoking or Juuling and something like the gum is, you know, inhaling nicotine is by far the best way to deliver nicotine to the body.
Dave, what are you doing to get nicotine now that it's banned?
I'm back to the gum. And as much as I think the ban was stupid in general, I think it was good for me. I had no business Juuling, so I'm back to the gum, and I think I'll be chewing the gum until the day I die.
Thanks for that, Dave. I'm going to let Jennifer respond to that and get the last word on this subject.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I have relatives that have you know, used nicotine gum for decades, and are not able to give it up and don't want to give it up. And it's, you know, it's better than smoking. Anything that can help you transition off of smoking is a good thing, in my view. And, you know, the Juul is supposed to be a gateway out of smoking, not a gateway into smoking. So I do understand that people have concerns that it's being used the other way as a gateway into smoking, but that's not what it was intended to be. And you know, we just have to educate people about what the proper uses of the product are.
All right. We could go another 10 minutes on this, but there is some other local news this week that, especially since I have the two of you, I want to make sure we get to, because I'm very interested in what you're going to have to say about it. The Massachusetts RMV, we now understand more about the depth of the problems at the state's RMV after an outside audit was released late last Friday. For almost 20 years, it turns out the RMV has failed to stay on top of alerts from other states about Massachusetts residents who broke traffic laws. Also, there's a backlog on violations by drivers with ignition interlock devices that has to do with alcohol testing, basically, and updating the records of drivers with new criminal violations. Some say that the Baker administration's war on wait times may be to blame, but Governor Baker says the problem's bigger than his administration. He wasn't in office 20 years ago. So let's dig into that. Callers, we want to hear from you. Do you feel safe on Massachusetts roads? How do you feel about what we now know about the RMV? Do you have faith in the state agency? Do you think we need to do something differently? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with, are you surprised by the findings of the audit, Marie?
No. Am I surprised that there are problems with bureaucracies and government? No. because and I think we need to stop thinking about this as Democrats or Republicans. We need to start thinking about how we fix our state. I think that we need, if we take the time to really dig in, we're going to find, I mean, they're sort of coming up and they're bubbling up, whether it's DCF, whether it's the drug labs, whether it's
state
the
police,
whether it's the state police. They're bubbling up. That tells you that there is a problem with our, a structural problem with our government apparatus.
So can government run well?
Yes.
Is it a permanent problem?
It can run well, but we then have to at least acknowledge that there's a problem, put a plan together, and begin to work at it. And then you also have to train people. The world, just as the world has modernized, we need to modernize the tools of government. And we have not done that. What we do is we stack things on top and pretend that it'll operate appropriately. Government is operated by people. Always think about church, right? Church is
the people.
Open government
the church
is,
and see all
exactly,
the people.
See all the people. Well, and so government are people and their structures. And so you have to create those structures. You have to train the people to be able to use them. And then you have to hold them accountable. And the arms of government that are supposed to be working on accountability should actually step up and do that as well.
Jennifer, what do you think?
I disagree that government can ever run well. I
think
I think it can run better. I think it can run much better. And you know, I think back to when my oldest daughter got her license, and we went into the RMV, and we're waiting and waiting and waiting. And I finally looked at her after we had been there for over an hour. This was to get her permit, and I said, "I just want you to understand, this is why I'm a conservative. Just look around. This is why." And you know, it is a problem of bureaucracy.
But we have a conservative in charge of the in charge of the state right now, who has been known and pitched himself as an urban mechanic, essentially, for the state. So I'm
right. So he's taken on, you know, the wait times and that issue. And I have to say, I notice a difference there. But, you know, the wait times have gone down a lot.
You did say 1 hour, not 4 hours.
Well, no, that was earlier. It's gotten a lot better. It definitely has. But I don't know why you can't take on both problems at once. And if it means bringing in an outside consultant and outsourcing some of this to the private sector, then that's what we need to do. Because sometimes government can't streamline government. Sometimes you need someone from the private sector looking at it and saying, you know, this is what we need to do. We need to make some dramatic changes. Now, unfortunately, that's very difficult to do in a unionized environment, but
let's take a call. Julie from Lincoln is on the line. Julie, what's on your mind?
So your question was whether I feel safe on Massachusetts roads.
Yeah.
And having personal experience with a family member who was medically unfit to drive, and I reported it to the RMB and nothing was done, I would say that no, and this is only going to get worse. We've already had multiple deaths of cancer patients who shouldn't have been driving and were driving, kill people. And, you know, I think with the aging population and with the failure of oversight, it's just going to get worse.
Julie, is your family member still driving?
He is still driving, you know, but due to my efforts, he had to go through a Spalding course. But, you know, I was fighting against the RMB, who basically said it was up to the doctors and the doctors weren't going to do anything about it. So,
all right. Thanks, Julie. So, Marie, where and how is accountability? I mean, Julie's talking about a failure in the system.
So I think there are various levels of accountability. I think, one, families should be accountable for their families. And so what Julie did was appropriate. I mean, I think sometimes we have to step in and say, you know what, you can't do this. And then we have to, in order to help the system work. So it's not so simply these people over there. It's also us. Second, we have to take a look internally about how the working of that particular agency and figure out whether or not it's been properly modernized, whether or not we've invested properly, whether or not we have the right people in place. I disagree with this idea that private sector can do things so much better. We're in a lot of mess because of private sector. So I don't necessarily believe that that's the road to go. I do believe that we can hold people accountable and then go back to train people appropriately. And then we have to be willing to call things out when we see it. Because I think what's happened is, for example, in the paper, they talked about a gentleman who actually received the information. and then just pass it on. The sense of responsibility that an employee should have for the work that they are being paid to do, someone should speak to that. I think we've lost that sense in our, not simply in our private sector, public sector, but as well in our public sector, that we are responsible and should actually do honorable work for honorable pay.
But one of the problems is, and this has been reported on widely by the Boston Globe, is that, you know, there are so many problems and backlogs that some of the employees say this would take years to clear up. And given that that's the case, that's the exact type of situation where maybe you bring in outside contractors and just get some of the backlog cleared up.
So let's stay on this outside, and I'll come back to you to answer this, Jennifer. Grant Thornton was hired to do this audit, $1.1 million, 53,000 documents they requested they never got. They even had to say in the end, not really an audit. Does that sort of belie what you're saying, or I think belie is the wrong word, give the lie to what you're saying in terms of an outside private contractor being efficient
because,
or effective?
No, because it wasn't about them. In that case, it was the attorneys withholding documents on grounds of privilege. And without, you know, knowing what the documents are, what the lawyer's reasoning was, I can't speak to whether or not that withholding was appropriate. But it certainly had nothing to do with the outside contractor. If anything, it makes the point, right? So you've got these backlogs of information that hasn't been plugged into the system, information from other states, information, you know, about people that shouldn't be driving for one reason or another. Let's just get in some private contractors and input the data.
So, Marie, what's wrong with clearing the decks?
So I think you can, but there are, I mean, honestly, in this modern day, can we not think of how we can use technology effectively in order to clear those decks?
Kind of sounds like no.
I mean, I just don't understand, and I don't understand why not. I mean, given the millions of documents that a bank or, you know, has to process every day, or most financial services agencies have to process every day. I don't understand why we can't figure that out. And so the question is, are we willing to think out of the box? Are we willing to come together, union, non-union, government, private sector, and solve the problem? Because there is a safety issue as it relates to our roads and the people on them. And so I actually believe that it can be done, but we have to have, one, the political will, be willing to invest in it, and stop pointing fingers.
All right. I think this is a good time to take a break. I'm going to ask you both to stick around. Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center, and Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, also the chief operating officer of a recreational and medical marijuana shop. That's a lot to say. Mm-hmm. Listeners, you stick with us, too, and get ready to call. The next thing we're going to talk about is impeachment. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stay with us. There's more coming. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston and our Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. This week, the White House made clear that it will not comply with any impeachment inquiry conducted by the U.S. House of Representatives. The inquiry began to look into whether Trump leveraged U.S. assets for a personal political favor having to do with the 2020 election. President Trump slammed the Democratic investigation in the House at a campaign rally in Minneapolis last night.
They know they can't win the 2020 election. So they're pursuing the insane impeachment witch hunt.
Democrats, for their side, have not backed down and say the president is obstructing justice. Here's Representative Adam Schiff, who is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee on Tuesday.
The failure to produce this witness, the failure to produce these documents, we consider yet additional strong evidence of obstruction of the constitutional functions of Congress.
So the question is, where does this leave us? And one argument is, in a constitutional crisis. So says Noah Feldman, a law professor at Harvard University.
The Constitution says that the House should be able to investigate, but the president almost literally said, I'm not unconstitutional, you're unconstitutional. Nothing in the Constitution tells us what should resolve that conflict.
Still with us to talk about all this is Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Thanks for staying with us, Jennifer.
No problem.
And Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, also the CEO of a cannabis company. Marie, thanks for sticking with us, too.
Good to be here.
And we hope you're still with us and are going to call in on impeachment. What do you think of the process? What comes next? Are we in a constitutional crisis? Are you rooting the Democrats on to do this? Or does this feel like something that's going to rend our society apart? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And actually, we had a caller already, so I'm going to take a caller right off the bat. Eric from Belmont, you are on the line. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm absolutely shocked that the Republicans have been holding out and not joining their Democratic colleagues in condemning and authorizing the continued, look into the impeachment.
Eric, so let me ask you, is that rhetoric or are you actually shocked?
No, I am shocked. I'm shocked that these gentlemen and ladies can take an oath, hold public office, get paid with public tax dollars, and still be so tribal, have such strong fidelity for their own kind, their own Republican.
Okay, Eric, thanks for that. That's a great setup for us to start this conversation, and Jennifer is ready to respond.
So I think that's a really interesting point, but I don't think it's tribal so much as self-interested.
Say some more about that.
Well, I think, every member of Congress's number one incentive is reelection. And for these Republicans, large portions of their electorate are Trump supporters. And so whether they agree with them or not, or whether they, feel that the president was wrong about X, Y, or Z, they're walking a very fine line, because the question for them is, do they want to get reelected? And if they lose, most elections are very close elections. So if they lose even, in some cases, 1 or 2 percentage points of the electorate, they've lost.
All right, so Marie, let me turn this to you, and I'm going to frame this question up to you very specifically. You have been an elected representative where you felt, I'm assuming, knowing you for a long time, great fidelity to the issues you felt you were brought to your role to represent. There was a poll this week that showed that 2/3 of Republican voters would be less likely to vote for their representative if that person voted for impeachment. And if you're a Republican lawmaker who believes passionately in the issues you were brought to office to represent, is that a fair calculus for you in thinking, I got to stay in office to represent all the other issues I came here to work on?
Yeah, but you also lift your hand up on that furrow. For me, it was the first Wednesday in January. To honor the Constitution and of whether it's the United States of America as well as your local local state. That is our true north. It is not simply about staying and getting elected. And if that is where we are in America, then we are in a really true constitutional crisis where the founding documents can totally be disregarded in self-interest. And that is a real problem. So I agree that that it's conflicted. I agree that it's difficult, but that's where leadership comes in. And leadership means that sometimes you take hits and sometimes you stand where it's uncomfortable, but you do the right thing. And the right thing for our country right now is for you to honor the Constitution and protect our government institutions. I know we not like to knock them, but I got to tell you, there's no better country for us to be able to really demonstrate how democracy can work. And when we begin to demonize the very arms of government that gives us all the protection that everybody runs here to come and get cover under, then we're in a very bad place in America.
I really appreciate the back and forth between you, so I'm going to let it keep going. Jennifer, go ahead.
Well, what people have to realize is impeachment is a political process. It's not a legal process.
And explain what that means. What does it mean when we say impeachment is a political process?
So it means that the United States House of Representatives can impeach a president for any abuse of power or political abuse. It doesn't have to be something that's against the law, per se. It doesn't have to be something that's unconstitutional, right? So if the president takes an action that's unconstitutional, the proper vehicle for resolving that really is the courts, right? So if an administrative agency takes an action that violates the separation of powers, you know, or violates somebody's rights.
But hasn't
that
the president
the
argued that you can't criminally prosecute him while he's president, and therefore the only option is impeachment?
Oh, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, is that because, but at the same time, he's also arguing that the impeachment process is unconstitutional and that it's political. And
right. Noah Feldman's, I'm not unconstitutional, you're unconstitutional.
Right. So he's actually arguing two contradictory things at the same time, right? On the one hand, he's arguing local prosecutors can't go after me, or federal prosecutors can't go after me because the president can't be sued or prosecuted, indicted while he's in office. And I think he's probably right about that. There are arguments on both sides. But impeachment is a political process. And as I understand it, and as I look at the founding documents, our founding fathers felt very clearly that they felt that the check on presidential power was congressional authority.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The lines are just boom, 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 boom. So I want to grab at least one call.
Absolutely.
Donna from Brockton.
Hi, I just want to say, if Trump doesn't have to abide by a subpoena, then what's stopping me from showing up to court when I'm subpoenaed? And that's all I have to say.
Well, Donna Marie is nodding at you, so I'm going to let her respond. Go ahead, Marie.
Right. Yes, impeachment is a political question. But it is a political process, and they set it up, and there are three branches of government, co-equal branches of government, right? You got the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, and that legislative branch has the power to call the executive to account, yes, for constitutional violations, or in what they did do was separated to say, look at, you know what, House of Representatives, you can go ahead and do the investigation. But because we know that you're that prosecutorial arm, we're going to leave it to the Senate to really put on a trial and take the evidence that you have and then make a decision. That's what they did. And then and so right now we're saying that the arms of that we rely on, so that rather than all of us becoming the wild, wild west, that we go to court, that we follow court procedure, and that we honor the regulations, the statutory regulations, and the findings of our judiciary, we're saying right now that our president has said, you know what, you don't have to honor the executive, the judiciary branch. You don't have to honor the legislative branch. I don't agree with it, so therefore I'm not going to do it.
Okay.
And just to be clear, I do believe that the president has to comply with these subpoenas. And of course, each subpoena is different, right? There may be some areas where Congress issued subpoenas that are completely inappropriate, and he doesn't have to respond to them. But as a general principle,
he does.
He does, absolutely.
Right. So I want to carefully craft another question to the two of you, and it's this three co-equal branches of government idea. Here's Noah Feldman again. He's the Harvard Law professor who wrote the piece saying we're in constitutional crisis, and he's talking about the pressure that could come to the Supreme Court to pick a side.
It's conceivable, I don't think it's likely, but it's conceivable that the Supreme Court might say, you know what, our name is Paul, this is between y'all. We have no role to play in this interbranch dispute. And if they said that, then that would effectively mean giving a win to the president.
All right. So my focus here is not the win to the president part, but it's the other part. Because as somebody who is passionate about democracy and really believes in the form of our government, I am so worried that if this fight winds up at the Supreme Court, that there's no way for the Supreme Court not to look political in a way that permanently damages its credibility and legitimacy.
So not sure that's right, that if the Supreme Court stays out, it gives the win to the president, because the Congress has every right, if they wanted to impeach the president and convict the president simply for not complying with the process.
As obstruction of justice, basically?
Or my point is, it doesn't even have to meet that legal standard, right? Because as I said at the beginning, impeachment is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives says it is. So if they want, in other words, just because hypothetically, if the Supreme Court says we're not going to get involved here, that's not the last word, because Congress can move forward
without that.
Right.
Okay. All right. Marie, anything you want to add to that? I find it very helpful.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And that just goes back to, so the House of Representatives can come up with a charge They then have to then send that charge over to the Senate, and the Senate has to be willing to try it. And if the Senate doesn't is not willing to try it, I think that's where you run into your problem. And the courts say no. And I'm going to defer to the constitutional experts then, because I do think then we're in a quandary.
Well, I think what will happen, and I say this predictively or descriptively, not normatively, is that even if the House were to impeach, it would go to the Senate. They would try it. They would uphold their constitutional duty to have the trial. But because the Senate is controlled by Republicans, they would ultimately vote to acquit. That would be my prediction of how things would turn out.
All right. I think we should end with our hubbubs, because there's been some heavy stuff. So let's get some brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Jennifer, you had a hubbub you wanted to bring?
Yeah, mine is the unlikely friendship of Ellen DeGeneres and George Bush, which, frankly, I think we need a lot more of in this country. But they were captured on film at a sporting event, and there was a big hubbub about it. And Ellen came out with a really nice statement about, yes, I'm friends with George Bush, and here's why that shouldn't be shocking. And I thought that was really terrific.
All right. Marie, how about you? Hubbub this week?
Yeah, my hubbub actually is really a thank you and a real call out for a wonderful gentleman who we lost this week.
Yeah.
And that was Billy McGonigal. And I have to say personally to him and his family, I am so sorry that we lost Bill. I think Bill was a real example to all of us about what public service is about, a real humanitarian, and a real who demonstrated, not by words but by deed, what we can do if we choose to truly adhere to the ideals of desegregation.
You know, we had him on just after his 40th year retirement. So he served for 40 years in the Boston housing. We had him on to talk about his retirement, and it was remarkable the length of service and dedication to the poor and the vulnerable and the marginalized in the city of Boston. You know, in listening to the two of you talk about the RMV and public management, et cetera, it's wonderful to be reminded that we do have really great public servants who are selfless and have the best interests of the
people. That's exactly right. And Bill McGonigal was that, Joe.
All right. Mine is a little silly, and I mean no disrespect to Bill McGonigal for bringing it afterward. There were a couple of weeks ago, I had this hubbub ready about a pig that had escaped in Wareham, and the police had recorded it in the police log as a ham on the lamb. And I was so disappointed because we didn't get to hubbubs that week, and I didn't get to use it. I'm like, where's my ham on the lamb? So then one of my colleagues today brought to my attention a story in the Daily News entitled, Mischievous Goat Donkey Go on the Lamb in Byfield. So I was like, more animals on the lamb for my hubbub this week. Swear to God, Sassy, a small goat, and Bradley, a miniature donkey, escaped at Sassy's urging, apparently, and wound up in the Newbury Town Library lawn, where the grass actually looked greener. So the library takes pictures, they post it on Facebook. A little while later, the owner sees it, picks up Sassy and Bradley, who have now been reinforced in their and right, or whatever it is, so that they will no longer go on the lamb. So while I didn't get to do ham on the lamb a couple of weeks ago, Sassy and Bradley, you have captured my heart. Be free, babies. Be free. That is my hubbub for this week. All right. Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, also the chief executive officer of a cannabis company. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
And Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. So great to have you on Week in Review.
So great to be here.
All right. And you listeners, stay with us. Coming up, the Pats are 6-0. I almost said 6-0, which was a sneak preview. But is Tom Brady worried? We'll check in on sports next. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.